20-6026, Allianz Life Insurance versus Muse. And for the appellant is Mr. McGuire. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, or maybe afternoon, depending on where you are. May it please the court. My name is Kent McGuire, and I'm appearing along with Linda McGuire for the appellant, Dr. Gene Muse. This is a factually complex case involving a complicated, difficult to follow long-term care policy with a mountain of conflicting factual evidence and inferences existing between the parties. An overarching or common error that we contend is consistently seen in the district court's orders dismissing Dr. Muse's counterclaims is a pattern and or preference to disregard and improperly weigh the evidence and inferences against the non-movement Dr. Muse. A clear example of this is seen in the bad faith claim, so I would like to begin there. The district court dismissed Dr. Muse's counterclaim for bad faith upon a finding that Dr. Muse was unable to establish a genuine dispute as to whether he was eligible for benefits under the policy, and therefore he could not prove coverage under the policy. Eligibility under this policy is met if Dr. Muse is certified by a licensed healthcare practitioner as being chronically ill, as that term is defined in the policy. Contrary to the court's findings, the record before the court contained medical certifications from three medical doctors, an occupational therapist, a physical therapist, and an RN, all certifying Dr. Muse as chronically ill. In addition, in the claim file, there are letters in October of 2015 and March of 2017 where Allianz found Dr. Muse eligible for benefits and authorized payments. And there is evidence of benefit payments that were made to Dr. Muse for almost a two-year period from July of 2015 through April of 2017. Instead of citing to this evidence that favors Dr. Muse's eligibility for the policy, the district court cited to deposition testimony of a Patty Winch, who was the principal claim consultant with Allianz and also testified as corporate representative. But he cited to her testimony where she said that their payments was not based on the fact that Dr. Muse was eligible under the policy. Well, not only is that testimony unbelievable on its face, it directly conflicts with the evidence I just referred to. There is no way the district court could have arrived at his decision without disregarding the evidence favoring Dr. Muse and or improperly weighing that evidence against him. Secondly, the district court erred relying.
If there was no duty to pay the claim, assuming the exclusion applied, does bad faith still apply?
Yes, Your Honor, because the district court did rely on a policy exclusion to deny benefits after payment stopped, so after the April 21, 17 date. Well, under Oklahoma law, the controlling issue in a bad faith case is not whether the insured is legally entitled to recover under the policy. Rather, it is what evidence that the insurance company used and relied on at the time it denied the claim. And so the only the knowledge and the belief of the insurer during the time the claim is being reviewed should be relevant. The appellee Allianz has conceded in this case that it did not deny Dr. Muse's claim at any time based on a policy exclusion. So under the controlling substantive law of Oklahoma on bad faith, the exclusion relied upon should not have even been considered in the bad faith claim. The district court also failed to make findings on the reasonableness of Allianz's claim conduct. Appellee Allianz claims there was a legitimate dispute regarding both whether Dr. Muse was chronically ill under the policy and whether Dr. Muse received covered services. Well, last December of 2020, the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals released for publication the case of Lynn versus Oklahoma Farm Bureau Mutual Insurance Company, which speaks directly to the legitimate dispute defense. In Lynn, the court acknowledged that, yes, there can be situations where the dispute That primarily being where you've got a situation where maybe it's you need to, an interpretation of the policy, a legal issue. In that situation, it may be possible for the court to determine reasonableness as a matter of law. But where the coverage dispute is purely factual, the question of reasonableness tends more towards being a jury question. Lynn reaffirmed the substantive law in Oklahoma that when there is conflicting evidence from which different inferences may be drawn regarding the reasonableness of the insurer's conduct, then what is reasonable is always a question to be determined by the trier of fact. Lynn further instructs that if the question involves whether there is a reasonable and legitimate factual dispute, then resolution of the legitimate dispute is a jury question. More recently, in the case of Coffin versus Covington Specialty Insurance, Judge Robin Coffin from the Western District of Oklahoma wrote this: the resolution of legitimate dispute requires a determination of which facts should be given what weight. Thus, as the court found in Lynn, the decision is one for the jury rather than the court. This case, like the facts in Lynn, and Lynn was a claim made by a cattle operator for theft of cattle. And they had a policy that would pay for theft if there was a finding that the theft was likely. So the case involved a complex factual situation. This case here is like Lynn. The issues here are factual disputes, such as, is Dr. Muse eligible for benefits under the policy, and did he receive covered services? So I argue the resolution of the legitimate dispute requires a determination of which facts should be given what weight. Thus, the decision was not for the district court to make, but for the jury. On this appeal,
could I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes.
This question kind of goes both to Alliance's, is it Alliance or Allianz?
Allianz.
Allianz? Okay. Well, this goes to whether both their argument on their declaratory relief, you know, it's your argument, the notice waiver issue. I think if I understand your argument correctly, is that they should not have succeeded on that declaratory relief because you never received notice, or essentially they had waived this whole argument about the exclusion that applied. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think that kind of transfers over, as I see it, into the whole bad faith argument, but maybe you don't see it that way.
No, Your Honor, I think that is correct. I think it does lead over to the bad faith argument.
So can you tell me a little bit more about that, the whole issue? What, did you have a pretrial order as you normally would before summary judgment motions were due?
No.
Or maybe that's not normal in your district, but
at some point, I don't remember the time, and at some point we did have a pretrial conference, but this issue about this whole exclusion did not come up until summary judgment briefing. Okay. We never knew about it. It was never raised at any time during the claim file, or you can say in the complaint. Allianz has conceded that exclusion wasn't relied on to deny the claim, and they have admitted that now they didn't have the full parameters of these agreements that they think are important between Dr. Muse, his caregiver, and a home health care agency. But given the concession that they didn't have the knowledge, how can their complaint have been based on that? And, you know, the argument of no notice is we didn't have a chance to discover information. Had I known that that was the issue in this case, I would have asked questions on depositions differently. I would have got concessions from the claims people that they never relied on that policy. And I would have gotten concessions, I believe, that the language of the policy that they rely on is ambiguous. And I'd like to touch on that just briefly, the ambiguity of this policy is in question. Because Dr. Muse had purchased a indemnity benefit rider that we say overrides and is in conflict with this policy exclusion. The rider reads that Dr. Muse would be entitled to full daily benefit regardless of actual charges incurred by him. You know, the language, that language sets out the fundamental purpose of the rider, that you are entitled to the full daily benefit without taking into account whether you incur actual charges or not. Allianz contends that the rider doesn't kick in unless you claim your claim is not subject to an exclusion of the policy. Yet the rider says that all definitions, provisions, limitations, and exceptions of the policy apply to the rider unless changed by the policy. Read together, the exclusion renders the rider meaningless, and if not meaningless, at least the two provisions are ambiguous.
And when did you first bring up the rider in terms of your argument that it works together with the exclusion, or it works to limit the exclusion? I presume you brought this up in your summary judgment, or well, maybe in your response, or
yes, yeah. Sure, in the response.
Because that would be the first that you would have known you needed to address the exclusion or its meaning.
Correct. That is correct. You're in the response to the brief and to their motion for summary judgment. And, you know, since the policy, the exclusion is ambiguous, the district court should have applied the law on ambiguities of contracts. As an adhesion contract, the exclusion language should have been construed strictly against the insurance company and in favor of Dr. Muse, but that was not done.
I didn't see where the district court, I don't believe it even considered the indemnity rider that you're talking about, did it?
You're correct, Your Honor. There was no mention or comment or writing by the district court about the rider, even though we did raise it in our response briefs.
Doesn't the rider just mean that if you incur charges, say, of $50 a day, you're still entitled to the $99 a day, even if the actual charges were less than the benefit?
Your Honor, that could be one reasonable interpretation of the policy, but I believe our interpretation is just as reasonable. That because when you bought the rider, when Dr. Muse bought the rider, it changed this policy from one of an indemnity slash reimbursement for your cost to one that says if you are eligible and get covered services, you get a set daily amount, regardless of your cost.
It says you have to have a covered service first, and under the limitation exclusion, there's no covered service if their interpretation is correct.
There is no further definition in the policy about what financial liability means, how much you have to have.
What do you think
covered, when you have to have it?
What do you think covered service means?
Well, covered services is a service that's provided under the policy. So home care is a covered service. A nursing home care would be a covered service. That's the covered service that we're talking about. And in this case,
these services would have been covered, but for the argument that it was provided at no charge in the absence of it would have been provided at no charge in the absence of insurance, right? So it still comes back. Don't we just still circle back to whether the exclusion applies here?
And for the coverage after April 17, whether the exclusion applies to that. Certainly not before the coverage before that time period. Your Honor, I have about a minute left, unless I can answer more questions. I'd like to reserve the remaining time.
Allianz?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Lisa Stewart for Allianz Life Insurance Company of North America. First, Judge Goodwin did not err in granting Allianz's motion for summary judgment on Muse's bad faith counterclaim. Significantly, the argument that Muse now presents that the district court failed to consider whether Allianz acted in bad faith during the time period it was paying Muse's claim, which they call the covered period, this argument was never presented to the district court such that the district court could address that argument in its order on the motion for summary judgment. As Muse has not asserted plain error in this case, this argument has been waived. in any event, there was no...
Counsel, yes. I'm having a bit of a problem with this payment of benefits provision under the policy language, because I kind of tend to read it the way it's argued. That is, that if you are eligible for benefits, then the rider kicks in and provides that the benefits due are the benefits provided, the maximum benefit provided under the policy, regardless of the actual charges incurred. I don't think that's ambiguous. I don't see where you could argue that that means something other than that. So help me through this, please.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Why
if you look
that
at the-
just trump all of your arguments and just leave you out in the cold?
No problem. If you look at the language of the indemnity benefit rider,
mm-hmm. Yes.
It does not eliminate the requirement that the insured must receive covered services. And covered services...
If you meet the payment of benefits provision under this policy, the benefit amount payable to you for covered services will be equal to the full daily benefits shown in the benefits information section, regardless of actual charges incurred. Now, what's ambiguous about that? I don't understand.
I don't believe that it is ambiguous, Your Honor, and we've never said that it is ambiguous. It's clear that once you establish that you're entitled to payment of benefits, which includes that you have received covered services, then this rider does apply. However, in Dr. Muse's case, the interpretation would be that because he did not receive covered services, because the services were excluded by the financial responsibility provision of the policy, you never reach this rider because you have to have benefits covered. And then all this rider does is it changes the benefit amount from what was actually charged to the full daily benefit provided by the policy. So what this is a way for the actual charges for covered services, once those have been established, to not be considered. So you still have to have some charges. You still have to have financial responsibility under the policy so that exclusion doesn't apply. But then once you meet those terms of the policy, you would pay based on the amount based on the indemnity benefit rider.
Why in the world would the policy want to cover more than actually incurred expenses?
I don't know why you would want to do that, Your Honor, but that is why it's worth something to the insured to have that rider. Because in that event, they only have to have actual charges for however much per day, and they are automatically entitled to the full daily benefit for that day.
Counsel, I'd like to take off on something that I think is connecting all of this, and that is this whole idea of whether or not you gave any notice at all that you were going to rely on the financial responsibility exclusion until you filed your motion for summary judgment. And it's not surprising to me that we're just now hearing this argument about what is the meaning of this indemnity benefit rider, because this is the first opportunity that plaintiffs have had to discuss that or to try to counter your exclusion argument. And, you know, as he said, as counsel said, he didn't have any opportunity to depose anyone on what this, you know, at what point did you rely on this exclusion? Did you rely on it in denying the claim? Does the indemnity rider apply? What does it mean? How does it apply? There was no discovery on any of this because the first anyone heard about it was in your motion for summary judgment. I would like to know why it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the district court to find that motion provided proper notice of this your intent to rely on the exclusion, the financial responsibility exclusion?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that, first of all, we did plead that this provision was applicable in our complaint.
You cited the provision, but there's no facts. There's no reliance. You don't say that you relied on it in denying the claim. There's nothing else. That's what the district court said. Why wasn't that an abuse of discretion? And if I'm reading your appeal brief correctly, you say it wasn't an abuse of discretion because you're now relying on a new reason, which is you didn't know that you could rely on this exclusion until you deposed fairly shortly before your summary judgment motion a couple of individuals. And so you didn't know until you filed your summary judgment. In that case, why was it appropriate not to permit to more discovery or require you to amend your complaint? There's no discovery on this.
There was never any request for any more discovery on this.
Why would they request it? You weren't claiming it. Normally you would have been in your claim denial. If you're relying on an exclusion to coverage, it doesn't come at the litigation stage in response or in a summary judgment motion. I'm just curious, how is it that plaintiffs were supposed to know you were relying on an explicit exclusion that you never relied on until summary judgment?
And how, well, again, Your Honor, it was pleaded in the complaint,
as a provision we were relying on.
Sure. And then secondarily, the reason that it was never given as a reason to deny the claim is because when Allianz requested the agreement between Dr. Muse and the home healthcare agency, they were given an agreement that indicated that Dr. Muse did have financial responsibility. It was not until Dr. Muse's attorney, Deborah McCormick, began sending letters to Allianz saying that Ms. Pearson was going to be bankrupted because she was not being paid because Allianz was not paying Dr. Muse. And so Dr. Muse was not paying the home health care.
I understand your position is that you really couldn't have known about it, which is contrary to your position that you pled it. But putting that aside, if the position is you didn't know about it till a couple of weeks before summary judgment, why didn't you move to amend your complaint to say, hey, we're now going to rely on an exclusion that we've never relied on, that's explicit in the policy, and give the plaintiffs an opportunity to say, well, we need some more discovery. We're not going to be ready for responding to summary judgment. Why? You see what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. And I believe that the rules allow the person responding to a motion for summary judgment to request additional time and to conduct discovery if they feel that is necessary.
They objected to your reliance. They also could do that. They instead chose to object to your reliance on the exclusion at this late date. And then the district court made a ruling on that, which is what I'm questioning you about now and asking, why wasn't that an abuse of discretion under these circumstances?
Well, it was not an abuse of discretion because because Dr. Muse's counsel had the opportunity to correct the situation and chose not to do so. The judge does have discretion to allow amendments.
How did it have discretion to correct the situation at that point, other than to object as they did? I'm not sure what else they should have done, and then raise it on appeal, which they're doing.
Well, but the discovery had not been completed, and they did ask witnesses about the financial responsibility exclusion.
That's my point. That's before you filed your motion and first asserted the exclusion.
It was
discovery preceded all that. And what Mr. McGuire has said in response at the district court was, I would have done discovery, I would have deposed all of those individuals and asked them about this exclusion and whether they relied on it when they denied my claim. And I wasn't allowed to do that because I didn't know you were relying on it. I'm asking why isn't that valid?
But they did not rely on it when they decided his claim because they were not aware that of the extent of the secret verbal agreement between Dr. Muse and the home health care agency.
I understand that's why you're saying now that that's why you didn't raise it. I think my point is, I'm still trying to get to the district court's decision, and I think you've answered my question, so I'm sorry.
I just have one follow-up question on that. Did the plaintiffs ask that the summary judgment proceedings be suspended so it could conduct additional discovery on this issue?
They did not, Your Honor. And I did want to address another issue that was raised regarding the pretrial report. In the district court, the pretrial report was not due until shortly before trial. And it was a couple of months after the summary judgment briefing. So there was still time remaining in the discovery period to conduct any additional discovery that might have been necessary. So I think that's an additional reason that the court did not abuse its discretion in refusing to hold that this was a newly raised claim.
If we interpret this payment of benefits rider as basically overriding the exclusion, the whole discovery due process issue becomes irrelevant, correct?
I'm having trouble wrapping my head around that.
In other words, if a senior citizen is determined to be entitled to benefits, whether he pays those benefits or whether they are provided on a voluntary basis or whether they are paid in part and provided on a voluntary basis in part, all of that becomes irrelevant if the benefit rider is interpreted as meaning that all you have to do is qualify for the benefit, and whether you avail yourself of it or not is irrelevant. At that point, the rider kicks in and you receive a sum certain per day during your period of eligibility. That would seem to me to trump all of these discovery and due process questions. But I may be wrong, and I'd like to hear your view as to why that is wrong.
I don't think that you could interpret the indemnity benefit rider in that way, because it would essentially eliminate all the terms of the policy if you interpret it in that manner, Your Honor.
What do you mean, all the terms of the policy?
Sure. If the indemnity benefit rider is purchased in order to make the policy owner automatically eligible, I mean, that's even worse than
once he meets the requirements of eligibility as otherwise set in the policy, which has nothing to do with the exclusion.
Well, Your Honor, I don't.
I see. I don't want to take your time answering my question, but it just seems to me that that's obvious to me is an obvious interpretation.
I'm not understanding that, Your Honor, but I see I'm out of time. So I would.
Judge and sir, if you want to restate your question.
Yes. Assuming that the policy provides benefits by virtue of an insured meeting the definition of being eligible for benefits as being unable to perform his substantial daily activities or having a severe cognitive impairment, assuming that is met, and assuming that we interpret the writer as saying that once those are met, that once you meet the payment of benefit provision, that then the policy provides for the payment of a sum certain, then at that point, the exclusion becomes irrelevant.
Well, I don't believe that it does, Your Honor, because if you look at the definition of payment of benefits, under the policy on page 7, it states that while this policy is in force, you will receive benefits if you satisfy the eligibility for benefits provision, you receive services covered under the policy, you satisfy the claim requirements in the claim procedures section, and you are in a benefit period, and finally, your claim is not subject to any limitation or exclusion contained in this policy.
Right. And it is that last sentence, the limitation or exclusion, that I thought that the writer trumps.
Well, I think you have to meet this payment of benefits provision before the writer is even considered, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your time's expired. And I think Mr. McGuire had a little bit of rebuttal time. Go ahead, Mr. McGuire. You're on mute.
Your Honor, Linda McGuire is going to take the rebuttal. Linda, you're on mute.
All right.
Okay. Am I off? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize. First of all, we raised the ambiguity of this exclusion read with the writer in our response to Allianz's motion for summary judgment. And we also raised it in our reply to our own motion for judgment on the pleadings because they responded with that exclusion as a reason to deny our motion. But the point is, read together, we're contending that this exclusion renders Muse's indemnity benefit rider meaningless. Allianz wants the rider to mean you will receive the full daily benefit regardless of charges incurred by you as long as you actually incur charges or financial liability. I think there's more than one way to read those two provisions together. And I think that's not what Dr. Muse thought he paid for because he thought that actual charges did not matter. I'm very low on time. I'll respond to a question if you have one.
I presume that you did no discovery on what the meaning of the indemnity rider was or how it's normally applied.
As I recall, Your Honor, when Mr. McGuire deposed Patty Winch, the lead claim handler, he asked, he asked if the claim had ever been denied on the basis of the exclusion. And he also asked her, so he's got this indemnity benefit rider. And I think she agreed that, yes, the actual charges for the care didn't matter as long as you were eligible for the benefits and received the covered services.
Well, just one quick follow up. If you were surprised or sandbagged by the argument, did you ask the court for that additional discovery would be helpful in responding to summary judgment?
Actually, we did not, Your Honor. And I will say that the summary judgment ruling, we really thought at least the court would address our surprise argument and address the ambiguity, but he did neither. And the summary judgment orders, as I recall, were issued about 4 days before our final pretrial papers were due. So at that point, discovery was closed and, we were proceeding to trial with effectively all of our claims thrown out.
All right, counsel, Judge.
Well, I just want to clarify. And so this deposition of the claims handler, what point where there was discussion of the exclusion itself as well as the indemnity rider, when did that occur?
I believe that occurred in April of 2019, I think. And again,
and the summary judgment motions, your
summary judgment motions were not due until late September of 2019. And I believe that discovery closed a few weeks later at some point in October.
So you did at least have some discovery that you could turn to respond to the argument, the new argument or new claim as far as the exclusion?
Well, only that the claim had never been denied for that purpose.
Okay. Just a clarification that the claim wasn't denied for that purpose.
Right.
And you cited that in response to summary judgment?
I'm sure we did. I would hope so. I know we certainly have it up here, but yes, I think that we talked about that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Your time's expired. The case shall be submitted and you're excused.